All right. Thank you very much, Lars. It's a great honor and a pleasure to be able to give this Blackboard lunch. And the aim of this is aimed towards astrophysicists, or at least people I don't know. So if I know you and you're expecting to get something out of it, you know, you're probably mistaken. But anyway, the title of the talk, Scattering Amplitudes, the Most Perfect Microscopic Structures in the Universe, is kind of an homage to a quote by Chandrasekhar around the early 80s. It's in his Nobel lecture, that black holes are the most perfect macroscopic structures, objects in the universe, because the only elements in their construction are their concepts of space and time. And what I want to try to convince you of here is that in this area of scattering amplitudes and in the things going on at this workshop, we have a picture of a kind of beauty and simplicity that takes place in scattering amplitudes that is sort of the short distance complement to the kinds of things that Chandrasekhar was studying in the very large. Now, I also have to point out that I'm wearing a t-shirt here, which was concocted by the students at TASSE 2014, some of whom are in the audience. And they do a t-shirt every year, but you gotta have a simple slogan or mantra to it. And that came from Spee, who kept harping on them, on shell good, off shell bad. And so one of the goals of this lecture is to have you be able to repeat this mantra coherently to somebody else, even if you're not a particle theorist, and explain to them what it means. Actually, if David Salzberg is listening, I also have to confess that I have a secret, bucket list entry, which is to have Sheldon Cooper wear this t-shirt during an episode of Big Bang Theory, and for him to repeat it while drunk dialing Stephen Hawking. So we'll see if that ever happens, David. And so, as a second benefit, if you happen to be, as an astrophysicist, watching some back episodes of Big Bang Theory and you see a whiteboard that has some Feynman-like graphs on it and a bunch of lambdas running around, you can tell your friends that you know what those lambdas mean. Okay, if I get far enough. So anyway, black holes have only these they're very simple, right? They have very few macroscopic states, at least at the classical level. They have just the mass and the, so there's the black hole. They have the mass, they have the charge, and they have the angular momentum. And that's basically it. And for a long time, black holes sort of just sat there and did nothing for all eternity. But then in September of 2015, some signals reached that indicated that more interesting reactions could happen in black hole theory. M1 plus M2 goes to M3 plus N gravitons, where N is very large. So again, this is a process that just has to do with our concepts of space and time. But now there's a lot more to it than just M, Q, and J. There's all sorts of angular momentum, the relative spins of all the things, and a big pattern of gravitons coming out. So one of the processes that is being studied theoretically at let me call gravitons H, at this scattering amplitude workshop is where you bring in two plane waves that are gravitons. These are the plane wave perturbations of Minkowski space, of course, and they're emanating radially outward from the event that LIGO saw and many others, which it's going to see in the future. In this case, in the scattering amplitude context, we don't worry about the radial nature in the near zone. We just think of having some Gedanken source of intense gravitational waves, plane waves, and we bring them in and scatter them off each other. And we ask, what are the probabilities for producing these gravitons? And in contrast to the LIGO or the astrophysical setup, where this N is absolutely enormous, where you're completely into the classical regime. Most of the things that we work on here are in the quantum regime, where you have very few quanta, where N is 2 or 3 or 5 or 8 or 20, but not, you know, 10 to the zillion, which were emitted in this collision. So, and in order to describe these kinds of processes, we draw Feynman diagrams. So you might have H1 and H2 coming in here, and they interact by exchanging gravitons. And again, we're theorists, so we're imagining things that aren't really true in the real world, which is that the coupling constant here, which is called kappa, which is something like the square root of g Newton, we're imagining that this isn't incredibly tiny, and so that these processes take place with some frequency instead of almost never in the real world. So, but in any case, these processes are other examples of things that are just made out of space and time. Now,
the action is?
What's that?
Can you say what the action is?
The action is the just the Einstein action. Although, in some cases, it will be other terms in theories that extend gravity. For example, N equals 8 supergravity. Actually, one of the themes of this whole approach to doing things that's represented by this program is that we try not to write down actions unless somebody asks us a question. So the spirit is in the nature of what was called S-matrix theory back in the 60s. And the idea is to try to use general principles to write down the general properties of scattering matrices. And then, oh yeah, by the way, this class of scattering matrices happens to be connected to that action, and this one to that action. But we try not to use the actions in the way that people normally would, which is to identify quadratic terms in the action. So when you expand this out, omitting lots of indices, where H is the perturbation of the metric, it has a quadratic term, which gives us the propagator. And then it has cubic terms, which gives us these vertices. And then it also has vertices like this. Five-point vertices. In fact, it has an infinite set of vertices. And that's why we don't like to write down the action unless somebody asks us to. But we'll come back to that a little bit later. Although part of this program is about gravity and about studying the scattering properties of gravity, not only at the classical level, but also at the quantum level, another aspect of the program is to study scattering amplitudes in gauge theory. So we call it gauge theory, or sometimes Yang-Mills theory. But these are actually connected, because there's a sense in which gravity is the square of gauge theory, which we'll talk about later. So we don't talk about these necessarily in isolation, but we keep track of the relations between them. But there are also motivations on the gauge theory side. And in that context, you're much more into the quantum few particle regime. So the gauge theory applications are justified by particle colliders, and applications to predicting event rates at particle colliders, like the Large Hadron Collider. And so it used to be that papers on scattering amplitudes would spend a paragraph about the justification for studying these things because of the physics of the LHC. And then later on, they would spend a sentence talking about the applications to the LHC. And now, maybe you're lucky if they even mention the LHC. So that's the indication of the evolution of an new branch of science, or at least mathematics. So anyway, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the LHC because, well, there was a similar workshop a year ago that I helped organize, which was more in that direction. But just to give a few timescales for the astrophysicists, let's start with something that everybody, all the astrophysicists recognize, which is, well, not the way I'm drawing it, so this is the Earth. This here, this is the center of the universe. This is Geneva, Switzerland. And so if we blow up the area around Geneva, let's see, there's some piece of Switzerland looks sort of like this. And then there's a ring here, which is 27 kilometers in circumference. And that's the LHC. And there are a couple detectors. Actually, there's more than a couple. Most of the things that these scattering amplitudes apply to are two detectors called ATLAS and CMS. And these are gigantic kiloton detectors. And so now we're going to zoom into one of them. And we're going to do a big zoom in. And now we have some bunches of protons. So they're basically on the order of 10 to the 10th protons here. And these are these bunches are about 15 microns across. And they're traveling at extremely close to the speed of light. So the energy of each proton is on the order of 6,500 GeV, whereas the rest mass of the proton is about 1 GeV. So they're moving pretty fast. And these two bunches collide, and they collide every 25 nanoseconds. So we get our version of the LIGO event every 25 nanoseconds. Now, most of these collisions are kind of boring, and so you have to sift through all of that. And every time they collide, you actually get 30 different examples of two protons colliding. They happen in the bunches are so intense that there are 30 different proton collisions, and the experimentalists have to find the interesting one in there, if there is one interesting one. Okay, so now we're going to do another zoom in. And we have a proton, which is actually extremely Lorentz contracted, but because of this large factor, so it should be a flat pancake moving this way. And we have another proton moving very fast this way. And we ask, what happens when they collide? Well, the protons are not elementary objects. That's why I've drawn them as blobs. But they have stuff inside them which, as far as we can tell, are elementary. For example, there are quarks inside the proton. And one of them might happen to hit something else inside the proton. For example, it could hit an antiquark. We usually draw the arrows on quarks this way and the arrows on antiquarks this way. And they can collide. Actually, one's going this way and one's going this way, and they annihilate. The arrow's being drawn backwards from the way the time direction is going. They annihilate into something else. For example, because they're electrically charged, they can annihilate through something we call a virtual photon, which is some quanta of the electromagnetic field. And then they might decay into something else which can be detected by the detectors. The proton has other stuff in it. It has other quarks. You might say it has three quarks, but actually it has plenty of antiquarks in it too. And it has the stuff that binds the quarks together, the gluons. So there's a lot of other stuff, and most of it goes down the beam pipe. Doesn't get disrupted much by this collision. And then you see stuff coming out of here. But the whole situation is much more complicated than this. See my t-shirt. So that t-shirt in the front row sort of shows lots of elements in the collision better than I can draw them on the blackboard. Basically, there's something hard that happens somewhere in the center of the collision. I have no idea where I'm pointing to. that's sort of this short distance process. But there are other things that happen For example, these quarks can easily radiate gluons. And those gluons can split into more gluons. And at the end of the day, you don't see the gluons in the detector. You see jets of hadrons. And that's sort of illustrated by the stuff in the outside of the collision, far away from the protons. So this is just one example. There's a huge number of processes that happen at the LHC. It's a broadband machine. It produces everything under the sun. And most of the things it produces are kind of boring, part of the standard model. By the way, let me just get the time scales right here. I mean, the size of the proton is about a Fermi, or 10 to the minus 15 meters. And the time it takes for stuff to happen here, well, we usually express things in terms of energies. And a typical scale being probed at the LHC is around 100 GeV to 1,000 GeV. So that's about 10 to the minus 3 Fermi, or 10 to the minus 18 meters, or 10 to the minus 26 seconds or something. So those are the typical time scales at the LHC. In order for these processes to happen with any regularity, well, they just don't with gravitons of the frequency radiated by LIGO. But if we imagine the frequency is getting so short, so these things had Planck scale energies, then this coupling actually involves energies of the gravitons, and it grows. And so eventually, these things would happen with great regularity. Of course, these would be pretty monstrous particles with energies of order 10 to the 19th GeV up near the Planck scale. So that's what we're implicitly thinking about when we draw these graphs for gravitons, whereas at the LHC, it's happening now at Geneva. Okay, so this is one possible outcome of the collision. And another possible outcome is something that was recorded or announced on July 14th, 2012, which is a date that sticks in Lars's mind, but for a different reason. So this was the Higgs boson. So this is the most important discovery of the LHC so far in particle collisions. So that was a process that's somewhat similar. Actually, you can produce the Higgs in different ways, and you can see it decay in different ways. But just one example is that, and the dominant production of the Higgs is actually bringing in these gluons, not the quarks. Quarks don't play any role in the dominant production mechanism of the Higgs. So the gluons actually don't even talk to the Higgs directly. So you need quantum mechanical stuff going on to make the Higgs in this process anyway. But the gluons talk to any kind of quark. And in particular, they talk to the heaviest quark of all, the top quark. And the top quark is heavy, and it gets its mass from the Higgs. So it talks to the Higgs pretty efficiently. So this is the way you produce the Higgs. But it's actually, in order to get very precise predictions for how often you make the Higgs, you have to take into account all of this radiation of gluons. And so people have calculated these processes with up to 3 additional gluons. And going along with that are multiple quantum loops. And so these are very important for having a precise knowledge of how often you produce the Higgs. And then, of course, the Higgs will decay in various ways, many of which are very hard to see. It can decay through a top quark or a W into a pair of photons. And then we can see those photons make a little bump on top of a big background. And that leads to discoveries and celebration and everything. So, but it's very important to understand in the cases where you don't get little nice little bumps what the backgrounds look like. And so there's a practical spin-off to all of this scattering amplitude work. So I just thought I would mention that, but now we're going to go and erase the LHC.
I'm still trying. trying to understand the comment you made 10 minutes ago about how when the LHC turned on, you started talking less about the LHC. the papers started talking less about it.
It was more of a sociological thing.
Right.
That the people who were working on this had to justify themselves by the connection to the LHC. And then there began to be a larger and larger community of people who became more and more interested in the beauty and the mathematical structure underlying the scattering amplitudes than perhaps to their application to the LHC. So the reason I chose this title was because this program is a lot about the beauty and the structure, and less than the program last year about the actual applications. There is still some of that.
Is that beauty and structure not significantly informed by these new measurements?
So we're waiting to see something new at the LHC. We discovered the Higgs boson as part of the standard model. So those equations have been around for a long time. Just because you have the equations doesn't mean you can calculate the probabilities. What the beauty and the structure and different methods do is they give you more efficient ways to calculate those probabilities. So at the moment, they help, I'd say, inform physicists doing work at the LHC by telling them what the backgrounds are more precisely. And to be fair, it's a real dialogue between experimentalists and theorists. The experimentalists don't trust the theorists ab initio. But so they always use data to determine their backgrounds. But they have to extrapolate the data. To extrapolate the data, they need to know something about ratios as predicted by theory. And the more precise we can make those predictions, the better they can do. And aside from the Higgs boson, nothing else has shown up yet in terms of new particles at the LHC. No supersymmetry, no compositeness indications yet. Stuff like that. And so the lesson is that the physicists are going to have to work very hard to see new physics at the LHC and to gain more precision by doing calculations of scattering amplitudes that seemed very difficult just a few years ago. But mostly when I said that was not really that people are not interested in the LHC. It was more a reflection of the fact that there's a whole community who's now studying this intrinsically and doesn't necessarily feel that they need to make a reference to the LHC at the introduction to their paper, which might be about relations to number theory or something. Any other questions before I erase the LHC? So why do we even think there's any beauty in these scattering amplitudes? Or why do we think that they're perfect in some way? And that's because of formulas like this. I'm going to write down a formula, and then we'll talk a little bit before we understand what the symbols in the formula mean. As an example, Steve Park and Tom Taylor in 1986. Well, actually, one thing was observed before that, which was that if you take N gluons and you polarize them, theoretically, I don't know how to do this very well experimentally, but if you polarize them in so that they're all right-hand circular, which is what we call plus, or maybe one of them is left-hand circular, minus, then it was found that if you calculate a tree amplitude, so this is at tree level, graphs that don't have any loops in them, so this amplitude, which we sometimes write as AN tree and label this guy by 1, this particle 1. So these were found to be 0 a little bit earlier, And then they considered the case where two of the particles had negative helicity, and all the other ones, one, two, all the way around to n. So these guys here had some very simple formula. Which consisted of something, which I'm going to explain in a little bit. Some kinematic quantities denoted by these angle brackets, where this one depends on the moment of these two particles, and the next one would depend on the particles 2 and 3. And there is this common denominator, common no matter where you put the numerator factors, but then you put the you get this LM bracket thing to the fourth, where these are the only two negative helicity particles. So all the other gluons are right-handed or have positive helicity. So that was a pretty fantastic result that some of it was a delayed reaction, but it stimulated a huge amount of work in this field to try to understand patterns like this and what was going on behind that. So these things, I'm going to explain them, but first I want to mention that these things are very simple, and they really would govern the behavior of gluons scattering at the LHC at very short distances. But in the real world, this coupling is not arbitrarily small. And so there are higher order corrections that happen, or what we call loops. Yeah, question? Yeah,
so do you get a formula like this just by symmetry considerations, or do you get it by direct calculation somehow?
So it's a little bit of both. But what I will say is that one of the secret things behind this formula is that this is for scattering of gluons in a theory that doesn't have any supersymmetry. But at tree level, it's exactly the same thing if you had some supersymmetry. If you had, in fact, the largest amount of supersymmetry you can have without getting gravitons and stuff into the game, 4 units of supersymmetry. And once you have that, you understand this from a symmetry perspective. And then this part you can also understand from the structure of kinematic limits. So sort of like symmetry, a little bit different. But you can more or less understand it using things that are pretty close to symmetry. And originally what they did was they calculated it using Feynman diagrams at the 5-point level and at the 6-point level. And they saw the pattern. And like any good physicist, they extrapolated to infinity, 5 and 6. In that case, it worked.
So why are there no terms like 1, 3?
Well, I've swept a lot under the rug. But in gauge theory, it is possible to divide up the Feynman diagrams into what we call different color orderings. So at the 4-point level, you would have... Here's the kinds of Feynman diagrams you would have in Yang-Mills theory. You would have a 4-point interaction. You would also have a two 3-point interactions. And we, you can draw, just combinatorically, there are 3 possible ways of doing this, where we call them the S-channel, the T-channel, and the U-channel graphs. This would lead to the thing you asked about, a pole in the 1-3 channel. So what we're actually doing is we're sorting these according to their color, and we are actually the full amplitude, I'll call this curly AN, is a sum over the things I'm writing here, AN tree, with different permutations, sigma 1 to sigma n minus 1, and then n. And they multiply certain color objects that are traces. And we can leave the last one fixed because of the cyclic property of the trace. So this is really the, this AN tree means the piece of the amplitude that has this color ordering. So those poles are there, they're just in some other term that's related by symmetry. Good question, though. All good questions. Any more? Okay, so basically, although they did this calculation using Feynman diagrams, it was completely obscure how it happened from the Feynman diagrams. And that's because Feynman diagrams have rules that involve things like this vertex, where this thing in the middle is the has momentum equal to k1 plus k2 squared, which is not equal to zero. And as we'll talk about in a second, this is called off-shell. And so the new philosophy is that you want to try to do everything on-shell. And then the on-shell quantities will all be gauge invariant, and the simplicity will emerge more naturally. And that's part of this slogan on the t-shirt. So, instead of Feynman diagrams, there's a heavy use of symmetry where it's relevant, but also analyticity and unitarity. And this was actually a very big thing back in the 1960s. And in fact, it was once said, and maybe David knows who said it, one of the most important discoveries in elementary particle physics was the existence of the complex plane. Some wag said it and never got proper credit for it. Anyway, in fact, there are more...
How do you get quantum fluctuations then? I mean, how do you view them?
You view their structure as being sort of analytically continued from real regions. So, for example, one way of thinking about it is called unitarity. If you want to build up a quantum loop, you do it by iterating. So this represents a scattering amplitude, which is the sum of all Feynman diagrams at the one loop level. And the imaginary part of that is given according to the Kutkosky rules by looking for intermediate on-shell states that cross the cuts. Now, in the version where you directly get this imaginary part, you are supposed to do an integral over these intermediate states. And these have real momenta. But there's a generalization of this where you don't actually do the integral, but you just match it to the types of integrals that you could have in a generic process. And you don't even insist that these momenta are real. They could be complex. But you can deduce the structure of the thing you're supposed to integrate from these cuts. So that's one way of getting quantum correction out of classical things. These are tree-level blobs, and this is a one-loop blob. But you can also iterate the process. You can get multi-loop integrands that you're supposed to integrate over by considering more complicated cuts. So in the real world where we need these loop amplitudes, I mentioned that at tree level, you can show, and I'll try to show it later, that this has this full n equals 4 supersymmetry. But when you go to the loop level, at this point, the theory knows what's going around the loop. It could just be gluons. It could be quarks, also, in the case of QCD. Or it could be the particles of n equals 4 super Yang mills, which are a different set of particles. So when you go and push this to the loop level, now you get different answers, which are much more complicated. And they're... So now this becomes theory dependent. So now we have the opportunity to make some value judgments about theories based on the simplicity of their amplitudes. This has nothing to do about whether they're real theories in the real world, but just some kind of ordering and simplicity. And so if we, just to give you a flavor for this, we have and the simpler they are, the fewer examples there are of them. So out here we have the stuff we get in the real world. So that includes gauge theories. The standard model gauge group is an SU3 for color. That's the strong interactions I was focusing on, but there's also a weak in electromagnetism comes out of here. And because this this symmetry here is broken through the Higgs mechanism, we get particle masses. And when you're doing scattering amplitudes, particle masses are very ugly and difficult. There are some heroic people who are dealing with them, but that's sort of difficult and ugly. And then sort of in here, there's the world of massless gauge theory, much simpler. And for a lot of what we do in QCD, we can work in this world. Because most of the gluons, I mean, we don't even see gluons. The detectors don't see gluons. The gluons, through this process, turn into jets of hadrons. But in the femto universe, the gluons are massless. They're very similar to photons, except that they interact with each other through trilinear vertices. So they're nonlinear, like gravitons. Anyway, in the massless gauge theory world, that applies to the gluons. We can calculate scattering amplitudes in the femto universe using that framework. And the quarks in that universe, most of them are massless. The up quark, down quark, strange and charm quarks all have masses at most 1.3 GeV. And the energies we're talking about are hundreds of GeV, so their masses are irrelevant. The B quark mass is not completely irrelevant, but largely it is. The one mass that really matters is the top quark mass, because that's 175 GeV. That's on the same scale as most of the LHC measurements. But if we ignore the top quark mass, we can more or less do an awful lot, totally in the context of massless gauge theory. But there are even simpler theories. There is a supersymmetric of course, supersymmetry can have masses too, but as long as we're going for simplicity, we'll make it a massless supersymmetric gauge theory. And when you just say supersymmetry, you implicitly have only one supercharge. We'll come back to that in a little bit too. And then we go to, within the context of gauge theory, we'll see that the most supersymmetric gauge theory you can have is n=4. Super long mills. But even there's a hierarchy of simplicity where the best case scenario in terms of simplicity is what's called planar n=4. Just to mention what planar means, when you have a super Yang mills, like a Yang mills theory, it's characterized by some kind of group. And the group, when we talk about these gauge theories, we let the number of colors be flexible. So it would be 3 for SU3 color, 2 for the weak interactions. And this SUNC, if we take the limit NC goes to infinity, holding lambda, which is G squared NC fixed, which is a limit that Tuft talked about in the 70s, Then we find, so this is called the planar limit, because diagrams like this go like some power of lambda, maybe lambda to the third. Whereas other diagrams, which you can't draw on a plane, like this, they go like roughly one power of nc lower. So if we're willing to take this limit, then all sorts of extra things happen, and the theory is believed to be integrable. So, and there are extra hallmarks of that. So anyway, this is just a rough guide. If you hear people walking down the hallway muttering n equals 4, they're probably talking about this theory. If they're muttering n equals 8, they're probably talking about gravity. Okay, just so you know. Okay, so now we gotta learn one thing, which is why the complex plane is so fantastic. Okay, but before we do this, let's just recall Einstein's relation equals mc squared. That's for a particle at rest with mass m, where c is the speed of light. Let's just boost that thing up to some spatial momentum p. And then this formula is mc squared squared plus pc squared. Of course, like all particle physicists, I'm going to set c to 1. So we have m squared plus p squared. And we don't like square roots, so p squared minus vector p squared is equal to m squared. And actually, we don't like masses anymore, so we'll just set that to 0. And now, of course, you all learned this in relativity at one point, that kmu is a 4 vector, which has time component equal to the energy, and x, y, and z components are given by this momentum. And so this just means that the thing we call k squared, which is the relativistic contraction okay, so this k is a light-like or null vector, k squared equals 0, so that's when the particle is on its mass shell. In this case, the mass shell is zero mass. So now that we know we're supposed to deal with these massless vectors, we can do the first scattering calculation among three massless particles, which is the three-point process. Oh, I should also mention that we usually like to take to move any incoming states to the outgoing side of the equation, but think of them as having negative their physical momenta. So in particular, they'll have negative energy. So in the three-point process, we have three vectors that add up to 0. But we also know that, and let's define Sij to be, for any one of these guys, 1 to 3, the sum of ki plus kj squared. So that's ki squared plus 2 ki dot kj plus kj squared, but we're going to set these guys to 0, so that's 2 ki dot kj. But at the same time, ki plus kj is minus the third guy, kk squared. Anyway, whatever that third guy is, he's 0. So we need to satisfy this constraint that the dot products of all these vectors are 0. But remember that they're given by E and P. So Ki is Ei. And furthermore, the magnitude of P is equal to E for each of these three particles. So we could factor out the E, and this is just, there's some unit vector here, n hat. So ki dot kj is ei ej 1 minus ni dot nj, which is, so the only way, the cosine of the angle between the two, so the only way we can satisfy this with real moment is to take theta ij to 0. In other words, two of these guys are parallel, but then if you add them up, you get this situation. So all you astrophysicists know that even in the vicinity of the gamma rays don't split into two photons unless there's something around to give them a kick. For example, a magnetic field in a magnetar, then maybe this can be important. Of course, there's another reason this doesn't happen, which is charge conservation. But you also know that gamma rays will propagate a long ways, and at that high energy, the mass of the electron is kind of unimportant, but yet they can't split into E plus E minus. Of course, if they come through near some field, like a nucleus, then they can split, and that's Bremsstrahlung. But you always have to give a little kick. If you don't do that, you can't do it, because this real kinematics is too singular to happen. So there are no three-point processes. But wait, we have complex momenta available. So with complex momenta, we can easily do this. We can have a particle with four vector 1, 0, 0, 1, and it can split into something which has, for example, so here I've split the sort of T and Z components in half, so they'll add back up again to this. And I've made them go off in the transverse direction, but I had to make it complex to make it work, because the magnitude of this is this squared minus these three squared. This squared minus this squared is zero, because this minus this squared was zero. So I needed to make this complex so that the sum of the squares of this would be zero. Otherwise, it's illegal. But with complex momenta, you can certainly do that. So we have a suspicion we're going to want some complex momenta in a second. But now I've got to show you one more piece of algebra, and then we'll be done with most of the algebra. So there's an intimate connection between massless momenta and zero determinant 2x2 matrices. So you remember the Pauli matrices from undergraduate quantum mechanics? Sigma 0 is the identity matrix, sigma z, sigma x, sigma y. Let's use the Pauli matrices to turn a four vector into a matrix. Let us contract. These are often denoted something like alpha, beta, dot. So these run from 1 to 2. So we're going to just contract k, the vector k, with these guys. So we get k 0, that's the time direction, plus kz, kx minus iky, k 0 minus kz, kx plus iky. So then the determinant, this is often just called alpha beta dot. So the determinant of this matrix K is simply K0 plus KZ, K0 minus KZ, minus KX squared minus KY squared, which is K0 squared minus KX squared minus KY squared, KZ squared, or it's just the four momentum contraction K squared. So if the mass is zero, then the determinant of this matrix is zero. So what do we know about 2x2 matrices that have zero determinant? Well, the only solution to that is that the matrix factorizes into the product of a row vector and a column vector. And that we now traditionally call this vector lambda alpha and this one lambda alpha dot. So whereas this thing in K mu, we think of this as transforming under Lorentz transformations with some vector representation of the Lorentz group. These things, these individual things also transform, but with the spin a half representations. And these spinners were invented by Weil and van der Verden in the 20s. And they were pretty much ignored for almost 30 years until the weak interactions were found to violate parity. And then they became useful. They weren't written exactly this way, but pretty close to that. So these things here know about K. You can write them down explicitly by putting some square roots in and factorizing the thing. So these things really depend on K. In fact, what they really are is something like, just to put it in more familiar terms, if you took a quantum field theory course and you had the U of K's, these would be the Dirac spinners. Then you can construct the lambdas from the positive chirality. If you put in this gamma phi projector, you can get them. But you can also just build them out of these in this simple massless case by factorizing this matrix. And so the notion is that if you have some simpler building blocks that are all the momenta are built out of that naturally enforce this massless condition, you shouldn't write the amplitude as a function of ki. You should just write it as a function of these lambdas and lambda tildes, where here the I runs over the number of particles. And there is one constraint, which is that the sum of lambda I, lambda tilde I is equal to zero. That's overall momentum conservation. And the basic kinematic variables, these are not Lorentz invariant. We usually build Lorentz invariant variables, but now we can build them directly out of the lambdas. So if we take lambda I alpha lambda j beta contracted with L epsilon alpha beta, that's an invariant, and that's called ij with an angle bracket. And then if we do the lambda tildes, it's contracted, oh, by the way, epsilon alpha beta, it's just the anti-symmetric matrix on two indices. These are the ij's. So these are complex quantities. They are, you can get the things that people are more used to out of them, though. So if you take ij and multiply it by ji, you see you have some epsilons, and then you have lambda alpha, lambda beta lambda beta dot j I. So you recognize here k, what we're calling kj, the 2x2 matrix. So you get to multiply the 2x2 matrix kj by the 2x2 matrix ki. And not surprisingly, when you contract the indices, it's the same as contracting the four-vector indices in between I and j. So you find that the product of this guy and this guy is this 2ki dot kj, which we often call the Mandelstam variable Sij. So we can recover all the old variables that people use, but they're really supposed to be thought of as functions of these new variables, these angle brackets, which are between these two component spinners, which are more natural when we're dealing with massless momenta. Another important thing to notice is that this matrix, if the k's are real, is Hermitian, and therefore there should be a relation between lambda and lambda tilde. So the relation is that lambda tilde is lambda I star if and only if k is real. So now we're all set up to go back to the three-point process and understand the virtues of complex momenta in a little more elegant way than just this choice I made here to split the thing up into two, to use complex momenta, but it's more or less the same thing. So recall that we found that these Sij's, which were the ki plus kj squareds, had to all be zero, and they were all of this form. But and in terms of real momenta, these were all zero. But if we go to complex momenta and we break the symmetry between left and right, then we can find, we can choose lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3 tilde all to be proportional. And that solves, sets all these to zero. But we can also keep the complex, the things that are no longer the complex conjugates, the lambdas, non-zero. And so we can find configurations where these are the zero and these are non-zero. And then we find that amplitudes for things with definite helicity can be non-zero. These are complex numbers at the three-point level. And they have the very simple structure that we saw for this endpoint amplitude. And in some sense, they're the seed for these endpoint amplitudes. So this is the gauge theory tree amplitude. And when we do the same thing in gravity, we find that this is A3 tree squared, exactly. When you try to do the same thing with Feynman diagrams, you can find gauges in which the off-shell 3-graviton vertex looks like the square of the Yang-Mills vertex, but it's a very gauge-dependent statement. This is an on-shell statement because we use complex kinematics to allow all three of these to be massless vectors, and so this is now a gauge-independent statement, and it's sort of the seed for a whole host of identities which were found by Kawhi, Lull, and Tai a long time ago, and sort of upgraded to the loop level by Svi, John Joseph Carrasco, and Henrik Johansson. And they basically say at the tree level that Mn is An prime with some permutations times some simple factors of the Mandelstam variables. So I hope I've kind of illustrated in this short lecture that there is some hidden beauty in both gauge theory and gravity, that they're kind of intimately linked to each other, that there are some theories in which this beauty is more transparent when we go to higher supersymmetries. I didn't have time to really go into the details of the supersymmetry, but if you want to know more, just ask any of us during the workshop.
Thanks a lot.
Beginning, you said that you don't really use Feynman diagrams or actions.
Yeah.
You rather use symmetry arguments. But isn't the distinction between tree and loop, we're talking about three-foot or four-foot vertices, exactly something you can only do when you have an action and Feynman rules?
Yeah. So there, we could say that we do like one very simple Feynman calculation. We could look at the three-point vertex. We could calculate it and then get this answer. And then we could attempt to get the rest of them more by analyticity. So if I had had a little more time or budgeted my time better, there are recursion relations that you can get that basically use analyticity in the complex momentum plane by changing this momentum by something z-dependent. And they lead to sums that allow you to recursively build up the on-shell four-point amplitudes and five-point amplitudes, all just seeded by the three-point vertex. However, sometimes that fails. And if you have a fundamental four-point vertex, like in phi of the fourth theory, you're not going to learn about it by staring at, you can stare at three-point amplitudes till you're blue in the face, and you still won't see this thing. So it doesn't always work. But the gauge theory and gravity theories that have the most sort of algebraic complexity at the Feynman level, ironically, are the ones that are simplest to sort of bootstrap up in this way using analyticity. I don't know if that completely answered your question, but yep.
So does all this technology improve the prospects of bringing back S-matrix theory to some fundamental position in physics?
It's sort of back. Not so much in a...
Sort of.
Yeah, well, the point is that in the old S-matrix theory, it wasn't really quite capable of doing the strong interactions. And one of the reasons is it's fundamentally non-perturbative. So when you say imaginary part of an amplitude is given by an equation like this, this equation is nonlinear because this is the same as this. But as soon as you put it in the context of perturbation theory, now the imaginary part of a loop amplitude, this is the loop. And now it's a linear problem. It's hierarchical. You put in trees and you build up loops. Or you put in simpler trees and you build up more complicated trees. So as soon as you have perturbation theory, that's an enormous crutch that helps you use the tools of analyticity much more effectively. Now, there are some things where you can do things more non-perturbatively. And the best case scenario is sort of planar n equals 4, where we have some exact solutions that take that use integrability, and we're trying to marry them with stuff like this for more general kinematics and try to do things exactly. And there are other cases where you can make progress like this in another context, which is conformal field theory. There you have a somewhat different problem, but you can kind of expand the answer, which is not a scattering amplitude, but a conformal four-point function in terms of conformal blocks, which are a way of representing the symmetry. And then you can use unitarity non-perturbatively to provide constraints. And very interesting theories are at the boundaries of what's allowed. So that's not in the scattering amplitudes domain, but it's philosophically very similar to what we're trying to do. Yep.
So since you have analyticity, it looks like you could extend to Euclidean space and do finite temperature statistical field theory at a critical point, say, where it's massless?
Maybe. The problem is, in some cases, the things you're trying to compute are really just sort of pure numbers. And the advantage of this is being able to analytically continue in functions and then learn something as a result. So this does better when there are more variables compared to something that's simple in the sense of being sort of maybe a pure number times the temperature to the right power of, unless you're talking about the critical fluctuations around it and exponents or.
And you just replace the quantum fluctuations with thermal fluctuations, but
well, you can imagine applying this to finite temperature perturbative calculations. Whether those are always suitable depends on the context, but yeah.
Typically, you have those quartic vertices.
I'm not saying you can't do anything without quartic vertices. When you have quartic vertices, you can still do a lot. It's just that you cannot only recurse off the three-point vertices.
All right, well, let's thank Lance and...